Hey, how are you?
Hey, I am doing great. Shelley and I just spent the weekend at the beach together. We got away for the weekend, and man, was it super relaxing. We had periods of really good weather at the beach, and I don't know, we sat around, we read, we played games, we watched a few shows, and just had time together. Nothing required of us. It was fantastic.
That is so nice.
Yeah. How are you?
I am doing pretty good. Let's see, what's going on in my world? I feel like I am just doing a normal day. It's been a good day. I have enjoyed the things, but I don't know that I have a ton of like, this is happening or that's happening. It's just sort of a normal day, which is delightful because I like my normal days, but yeah, well, I feel like I ought to have something else to say.
Okay. So that's actually why I called. It's odd to me how much pressure we put on ourselves, I think particularly for this podcast, to have more going on. Like, I should have more to say, or I should have more that I'm thinking about or processing or whatever. And our podcast is really geared toward that type of thing. We're here to talk about how we're growing spiritually, what we're thinking about, what we're learning, all of those things. And yet, sometimes we just don't have it. Like, that's just not, life's fine. There's nothing wrong, but there's not something meaty or substantive going on.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you make this great point. If we're here to talk about spiritual growth, for as much of the church history that I am aware of, which is not everything by any stretch of the imagination, but as much of it as I am aware of, other than the last few generations, generally speaking, I think what people would have said was that doing the same thing over and over again is what spiritual growth is all about. Not about having new realizations or new things to say or adding this piece into my life or that piece into my life, right? Isn't it the general idea, keep doing the same things a lot for a long time, and that's where maturity and growth happen?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so, but it's interesting. We launched this podcast right in the midst of me going to seminary. And the four and a half years I was in seminary, that was not my experience. There was always something new. There was always something, you know, shiny to chase after. There was all this novelty. And now that my spiritual life is a little bit more just in the day-to-day kind of normal range, it's fascinating how that changes what I have to talk about.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And so I guess what I'm curious about is, where is the locus of your spiritual life now?
Yeah, I think it's in transition because cognitive is definitely where I'm comfortable. And so I still pursue a lot of those activities in order to keep that part of my spiritual life alive. But what I'm wanting to grow in is more the contemplative, the spending time with God, kind of unstructured, if you will, non-heady, and more experiential, more relational, more present with. And it doesn't produce a lot of thoughts, if you will, because it's learning to grow in relationship and in awareness of God's presence. And that just takes time. And like you said, it's that day in, day out experience that ultimately produces spiritual growth, but it isn't exciting to talk about.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me because I have been deeply drawn to the contemplative side of the spiritual world. You're right. One of the things the contemplative is all about is silence, right? And there's not a lot to talk about when you're focusing on the silence and the experiential and those kinds of things.
Well, and even more than that, to talk about them is false, or it feels false to me, because I'm not a master of silence. I'm not a master of contemplative prayer. I don't have anything to share with the broader world on that. I am in such an early stage of development when it comes to this that I just need to sit and do it and not talk about it, because talking about it brings it back into the headspace and the academic space, and it just falsifies the whole thing.
Yeah, I have this great compilation of sayings of the early desert fathers. And one of them that I've always been struck by in this regard, he talks about how the inner life is like a fire and the mouth is like the door to the furnace. And when I was a kid and I had a stove, sometimes when the fire was getting going, you had to keep the door closed because you didn't want to let the cold air into the stove. You wanted to let it heat the space up and kind of get hot without opening the door. And so there's this way in which I think, for me at least, I don't know that this is universal. For me, there are sometimes when talking about things too early lessens them or lets the heat out of the experience in my life. And I think you're exactly right. You talked about how talking about them brings it back into the headspace. And I think there are times when it's too fragile.
Mm.
And the shift from heart to head, it's not ready for that shift yet. And I've had to learn this lesson really slowly. And so it's cool to hear you share that lesson, because there are times I have shared something only to see it fall apart in my life as soon as I share it. Like, that feels like a trend.
Mm.
If I talk about it too soon, it starts to fall apart.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so I think both of us at present are pursuing a more contemplative engagement with God. And that leaves us in a quandary with this podcast, because we come to this podcast to talk about spiritual formation through the lens of friendship. And right now, at least in my life, my spiritual formation is, I like the way you said that, too fragile to turn it into a head conversation. And I don't know where you happen to be at, but it's hard for me to talk about my spiritual formation right now, because I really need to leave it in that experiential realm of engaging with God.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think this is a great point. When you talk about something, you automatically put yourself in the position of teaching or leading or influencing, right?
Yeah.
You know, another piece of this is that the Bible commends silence as a corporate discipline, meaning I'm not going to talk about this with you. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'm not going to... The fact that I have wisdom doesn't mean I ought to share it.
Yeah.
And maybe we are just still compulsive fixers. And that's why we feel like we ought to constantly be sharing.
I have to say, I'm a compulsive teacher. Like, I have never held the role of senior pastor, or even, let me back up. My only pastoral title was youth pastor for a little less than 2 years. And beyond that, I've never held the role of pastor in any capacity. And yet, I felt called to pastoral ministry when I was 13 years old. And so my brain has always moved very quickly to, what am I learning, to how do I teach this? And I can imagine how much worse that would be had I spent more time with any degree of a pastoral title. Mm. But my brain still does this. And I've recognized this in myself and just said, okay, when is that just a nugget for me? And to share it would cheapen it, or would somehow deflect from the growth that I need to do in light of this truth. And I think it's that deflecting that I'm really, really good at. Oh, that hits hard. How would I teach that? And it's an almost a defense mechanism for actually applying it, learning it, growing into it.
I think it's even, at least for me, it's even broader than that. I don't like to sit still with any experience. If something bothers me, I want to deal with it. If there's a problem, I want to fix it. If I experience something, I have to share it. Just experiencing and then being with the experience. You know, this is the, on sort of a practical level, when we were on vacation this last year, I think I took between 900 and 1,000 pictures. There's obviously nothing wrong with taking pictures, even 1,000 pictures on a vacation. But I do think that at least for me, that speaks to, I've got to capture this. I got to post this. I've got to something this, rather than just, I have to be here now.
Hmm.
I think for me, that also spills over into my spiritual life and into what I am learning and experiencing. And there's this sort of need to corporatize, meaning like make it about we instead of me, or this need to be a conduit rather than a receptacle. But I think you're right. I think that short circuits the work God's wanting to do sometimes, maybe all the time.
Yeah, there's so much there that I want to respond to. I think we as a culture do far too much of the receptacle and not enough of the conduit. So I don't want to make this an absolute for everybody in every circumstance, but I also really resonate with what you're saying, that sometimes we need to, especially with those hard truths, especially with those growth edges that we sense, we have to just let that stew in us and let it do its work in us. But it's not just the hard stuff. Like, to reflect on my weekend with Shelley this weekend, there were lots of times we weren't doing anything in particular. There were times when we were walking on the beach and not really saying anything. There were times when we were playing a board game and just kind of focused on the board game. And in those moments, I felt like this pathological need to have serious conversation. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, we're wasting our time here. We should really be diving in. Like, how is life for you? We haven't caught up in, you know, really deep ways. We should probably like really get into it. But wasting time together is a wonderful thing, and I don't do it well. And I think that's that aspect also of the contemplative life, where I am literally just wasting time with God. And it's not to say that he can't speak or that there might not be some encounter or something like that, but the idea that I might get up from a time with God and not have anything tangible to report on, or to a new thought to think, or a new experience to tuck in my pocket, it might just be time, quote unquote, wasted, but wasted in company, wasted together, is so hard for me.
That's a great point. We are always looking in our relationships for return on investment, aren't we?
Yeah.
And for me as well, I feel like I ought to be constantly being productive. And sometimes being productive is not the way I want to grade my experience.
Hmm. So what has this meant for you? Has this meant that you move on from defining your experience at all, or grading your experience at all, and the grading system is what's wrong? Or have you found a new scale by which to evaluate your time?
You know, I'm going to pull in here some things that are not directly from the Christian tradition. They're really from the mindfulness tradition, which is deeply influenced by Buddhist thought, and yet I think offers us an alternative that's very helpful. One of the things about Buddhist meditation that I think is interesting is there is no doing it right or doing it wrong. Letting go of the self-analysis is part of the point, because you can't be here and now and evaluate in the present, am I here and now? Because the moment I start evaluating, am I here and now, I'm not here and now anymore.
Okay, so that makes sense to me from an experiential place. But I know that there are folks in our audience that hear you talk about Buddhist meditation and immediately assume that has no place in a Christian spiritual walk whatsoever, that these things can't belong together, or if they happen to, it's an accident of Buddhism, and we have to find an explicit justification for it within the Bible or within the Christian tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a huge amount of Christian tradition that invites us to practice paying attention to God. And I think that there's a lot of ways that this is done, training our minds to be attentive to a verse, training our minds to be attentive to an idea, training our minds to be attentive to a particular prayer. Really, so much of this is just bringing your attention to something specific in the present moment. But the one thing I would say, sort of in theological defense of not overanalyzing my relationship with God, if I am analyzing my relationship with God, my attention is on me. It's not on God. Right?
Yeah. I was trying to come up with in my head some way to disprove that, or, but no, you're exactly right.
You know, we talked a few weeks ago how the father tradition of churches are at times and in their least ideal manifestations inclined perhaps to worship the Bible a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of us, and by some of us I mean me and people like me, may be inclined to worship growth in that same way. And maybe one of the essential elements of authentic contemplative experience. And part of, you know, one of the things we've talked about many times, I remember a couple of years ago when you really started praying by bringing your feelings into your prayer life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an active effort to bring the full and authentic you into conversation with God.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're going for. How do I bring the full me into the conversation rather than how do I fix myself for the conversation? Which is, I honestly think, what we're doing sometimes.
What do you mean fix ourselves for the conversation?
How do I grow? Ultimately is a way of focusing on how do I be good? Why am I trying to be good? What made that the goal?
Yeah.
In the majority of our cases, I think it's so that I can be okay with Jesus.
Well, yeah, right? Or not feel guilty or not feel like God is mad at me or something like that, or almost like earning his approval or something.
I think there's more of that than we, the mature and godly, really want to admit. Mature and godly in very obvious quotations there.
Right. Yeah. And so if the point is not those things, and if the point is relationship, well, then you have to kill time together. You have to waste time together. And you can't, I can't say that walking on the beach with my wife and saying nothing was a waste of time, nor would it be a waste of time to spend time in silence with God and then get up and call it a day. But that feels so wrong. And it's a very different experience than the heady, new, shiny novelty of theological concepts that came fast and furious in seminary.
Absolutely. Well, and it's, at least for me, it's a very hard practice. I mean, if I can be real practical about my experience of this morning, I set aside time to be with God. I didn't have a lot of structure in place around what that needed to look like. I just really wanted to be still with God. Within 3 or 4 minutes, I was thinking about really exciting and interesting things that don't necessarily have anything to do with, I almost said that don't have anything to do with my relationship with God, which is proof that we have another problem that I probably need to talk about at some point in a future episode about what it means to be deeply dualistic in one's life. But before I was aware of it, I was up and moving and acting on my thoughts and lost the moment with God to my own action.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that is my Americanness. I don't know if that's my ADHD. I don't know if that's my being a male. I don't know what that is, but I know that that is not abnormal for me.
Hmm.
It's so hard to be still when my mind starts to spin.
Yes, it really is.
And to welcome the spinning into the stillness, right? Like, it's not trying to push it out and pretend that's not part of my relationship with God. It's not trying to go do something about it. It's being present with God with a spinning mind. I have no idea how to do that.
Well, and you bring up such a good point. Like, you have been practicing what I would call mindful Christianity for some time now. And you're describing that that was your experience literally today. Mm-hmm. And so it makes me ask the question, like, because this is a question I ask myself. This is not, I'm not trying to pick on you by asking this. How do we define growth or progress or like, I'm actually getting somewhere? I mean, I know earlier you said that's the wrong question. And so I ask it a little bit hesitantly, but that's really where my brain goes, because if I'm going to continue practicing this, and if I'm going to continue engaging with God in this way, and, you know, years down the line, I'm still just as distractible and just as lost, have I grown? Is there any change? Has it been worth it? Again, I'm struggling for a grading system. I'm both asking the question and telling you not to answer me in the same moment.
Well, I will offer an analogy that does neither.
I can't tell if this is going to be helpful or not, but this, okay, go ahead.
I don't know either.
Okay.
Again, coming back to mindfulness practices, one of the things you do in mindfulness is you actively pay attention to your breathing. This is not to empty your mind or any of those things that, if any of our readers have a negative view of mindfulness, sometime we could talk about that, but that's not what we're doing. It really is just paying attention to something simple so that you can see what thoughts arise in your head. But what's interesting is that when you're paying attention to your breathing, you are not supposed to control it. So you're not supposed to force yourself to breathe slower. You're not winning if you breathe fewer breaths. You're just supposed to be paying attention. I've been doing this for not a short amount of time. There was a time where I thought I was perfectly good at this. And then I realized I was controlling my breath, even when I didn't think I was. Just by paying attention to it, I started to take control of it.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's been years. And every once in a while, I will notice, I don't think I controlled that breath. But what I have to welcome into the moment is the fact that sometimes I control my breath and sometimes I don't. And that's all okay, because that's who I am and where I'm at in this journey of mindfulness and meditation and silence and stillness. I think that offers something about how we should see growth. Let me be clear here. There is a stage of spiritual growth in which there are obvious practices we need to develop in our lives. The Bible is desperately needed in the spiritual life. Community is desperately needed in the spiritual life. Sacrificial service and giving and all those, very important. This is not to say that disciplines aren't important, and there is a phase of developing those things that is co-concurrent with what we're talking about. I wouldn't claim to have mastered any of those things. But perhaps to balance that off, there is this other practice or this other set of contemplative practices that are not measurable. And maybe some people are more comfortable with the measurable and some people are more comfortable with the not measurable. But spiritual growth invites us to participate in both. And I think Some will agitate some of us and others will agitate others of us. And that's great.
Yeah. It's that concurrent track that you're talking about that I am really feeling in this stage. Because like I said, it's not as though I'm not engaging with the Bible, right? I'm translating the Bible. I'm reading my Bible. I am going to sermon prep team. I'm going to church. We're having these conversations. Like, I'm doing the things. But as we record today, it's in the middle of Lent, and I looked at all of these different options that I could use in my Lenten journey. And there were podcasts I could listen to. There were scripted Bible readings that I could listen to. There were books that I could read. There were practices that I could engage in. And there were all these different things. And when I sat down to like, oh, I could read this book or whatever, I felt like God was saying, what, do you not have enough thoughts in your head? Is that the deficit that you have right now? You need more information? Or do you need more relationship? Because honestly, if you've got a deficit, it's there. So why don't you spend time pursuing relationship? And it was like, okay, I don't need to add another head practice. I need to add a relational practice.
Absolutely. And I think you're right, kind of wrapping back to where you started. I think the new theological idea, the next exciting spiritual book, the next exciting YouTube video or podcast or whatever can be a distraction from the deepening work that doesn't feel like it's doing anything new and doesn't give you anything to talk about afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to the audience and just ask you, what is your experience with developing a true relationship with God looked like? How have you leaned into that relational side of being a Christian? And yeah, I don't even want to say anything more because how has that worked? What's your secret? You know, all that stuff. That's all so productivity oriented. I just invite you to comment on it and maybe share this episode with a friend and talk about how you could lean in a little more into the relational side of being a Christian.
Wow, that's so good.
All right. Well, oddly enough, this is the part of our show where we turn to what else have you been thinking about? So Josh from Missouri, I assume that you have some thoughts.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this may relate to what we just said, though I had jotted this thought down before we started talking. As a person in the coaching profession, one of the things I was thinking about today was this continuum that helpers are on. There's a lot of ways you can describe different helping professions: pastor, therapist, coach, mentor, discipler, all sorts of things. But one continuum that you could place these folks on is a continuum between a leader-determined outcome and a self-determined outcome. Mm-hmm. So who's determining the process? You know, when I was pastoring, the younger the believer was, the further towards a leader-determined outcome it leaned. The more mature the believer was, the more towards a self-determined outcome it leaned. And now as a coach, it is fully over to self-determined outcome. I don't input anything into the conversation. What's interesting to me about that, as I continue to have some coaching, some discipling conversations with various people, is that in a self-determined conversation, generally speaking, it is difficult for me, the coach, because I have to give up my desire to control people and to control outcomes. And that means people move forward slower than I think they should, or in a slightly different direction than I think they ought. What's amazing to me is that when it is self-determined, there is almost always movement. I don't ever have to worry about getting my thoughts to stick. if I help them think their thoughts, there is an inherent drive that helps people do what they need to do.
Mm.
And that is so worth it. Over the years, I have leaned more and more towards self-determined outcome conversations, and I continue to land there. And that's just super interesting to me.
Hmm. That's so funny. That reminds me of a moment this weekend. I pulled up a video that I was going to watch for school, and it was an interview with Carl Rogers that took place back in the 80s when he was himself in his 80s. And it was on person-centered therapy. And Shelley took a look at the title of the video and went, isn't all therapy person-centered? Like, or client-centered? And it was funny because at the time that Carl Rogers was super influential, the answer was no. It was very much like clinicians, you know, doing an assessment and giving a diagnosis and then treating based on that diagnosis. It was all very expert-led. And I know what's wrong with you and I know how to fix it. And Carl Rogers came along and was like, actually, can we just listen to them? They have insight into their own story and their own drives and motives and ways that they'd like to grow that are really, really important. That was so controversial in his time. And it's funny how things have shifted. And, you know, therapy is very much client-centered in a way that was unimaginable during his tenure.
It's amazing how these things ebb and flow, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. But, well, what about you? Despite the fact that you are not drinking from a fire hose lately, what thoughts have you been thinking about?
Yeah, so I'm continuing to read Richard Bauckham's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And it's a fascinating book. And he continues to talk in these chapters about Peter's influence on the book of Mark. You know, there was an early church father named Papias who claimed that Peter gave his testimony, if you will, or his life story to Mark, and Mark went and wrote the book of Mark with that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of scholars have discredited that over the years and said, this doesn't add up. This isn't all from Peter's perspective. It's a much more omniscient perspective than just that. And beyond that, some of what is written here is actually pretty critical of Peter and shows his foibles in ways that it's hard to imagine Peter would have wanted them put out there. He was a key leader in the early church, and these scholars have a hard time believing that Peter would put his story, the hard parts of his story, on display while being so influential. So Bauckham goes on to describe why he believes we should take another look at this research and these scholarly opinions and say, well, maybe Papias was right, and he gives a whole litany of reasons why he thinks that. And so I guess what I'm left with is, if Bauckham is right and Papias is right, that Peter put this out there, it's fascinating to me that Peter would be so open with his shortcomings, and that would be part of his gospel presentation. This is how Jesus literally transformed me, and this is what I looked like in the midst of that transformation. Even after I declared that he was the Messiah and he said, the keys of the kingdom were going to be handed to me. And then I went out and I just brashly tried to use those keys of the kingdom and I failed so miserably. He put all that out there for us to read it. And even if we take a step back and we say, okay, well, but all of that is just a big if, because we don't really know if Peter influenced Mark's gospel. Okay, fine. Then let's take Paul, for example. And Paul very clearly is telling people, hey, I used to murder Christians. I was zealous for the law, and I was murdering all these Christians. And now I are one. And all throughout the Bible, right? All of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their foibles on such prominent display. And on through Scripture, we could quote more and more and more people. It seems that human failure and human inadequacy is a necessary component of telling God's story of redemption.
Yeah, I think that there's something so important about this, because it is only in telling our own weaknesses, foibles, and failures that we shift from telling our story to God's story.
Hmm.
You know, it's so easy even to accidentally make God a secondary character in my story.
Hmm.
But if I admit that I'm a mess, not that I was a mess 20 years ago, that I'm not that impressive today, that I made a mistake yesterday, then suddenly I am shifting attention from me as the hero of the story to God as the hero of the story.
Yep.
I think that's so important.
And the fact that Peter could understand that from the outset and say, no, Mark, please tell these parts of the story too. They're important.
Well, and I got to say, when your greatest weakness is clearly brashness, it definitely fits with Peter as described in the Gospels, that Peter would be the one to tell his own weaknesses. Immediately I think to myself, yep, that scans. This is the guy who'd be like, oh yeah, included, because I'm an idiot.
Well, right. And it's probably one of those things that, like, he was so brash and so impulsive that there was no way he could even hide that as part of his character, right? Like, you may as well embrace it because everybody knows it.
Absolutely. Well, and I think you're right. When I think about Mark, the gospel, being from Peter's perspective, I am so grateful because I am inspired by Peter's vulnerability and transparency. And as a leader, that is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good. But now it is time for the Witch Josh.
Dun, dun, dun. All right. And this week's Witch Josh is Witch Josh climbed a mountain with his 9-year-old son. And yes. On three, the answer is 1, 2, 3, me.
Both of us.
Oh. Both of us. Okay, so before we laugh at the fact that we do the exact same things and are the same person, tell your story.
Well, yeah, this is fascinating to me. We only found out, like, right before we hit record today that this is both of us. This originally went on the list as me. So my story is that my youngest son and I went and climbed South Sister. So in Central Oregon, in the Cascades, there are three mountain peaks right next to one another, and they're called the Three Sisters, and their names are Faith, Hope, and Love. And South Sister is climbable even by a novice. You don't have to use any ropes or anything like that. You just have to wait for all the snow to melt in late summer, and then you can literally climb all the way to the top and stand on the summit, which is 10,358 feet. It's a very high peak. And even though you don't need any specialty equipment, it is a daunting hike. There is a bunch of scree. And for those who don't know what scree is, it's just loose rock that's not quite sand, but it kind of operates that way. And so you might take a step, and then as you are putting weight on your step, you're sliding back down about 70% of the step you just took. And then, so every step is just, you're not getting very far. And the whole last mile of the climb is all just scree, and you're already tired from climbing this mountain. So Jonas was 9 years old, and we made it all the way to the summit. And there were times I didn't think he was going to keep going. He was so exhausted. But every time we took a break, I just kind of let him decide what we were going to do. And he would just turn around and keep going up the mountain. I was so proud of him. But he used up every drop of strength making it to the top of the mountain. And then we had set up camp about halfway up the mountain. there was no shelter. There was no place to sleep other than the tents that we had left behind. And so we had to hike back to our tents. It was probably another 5 miles back down the mountain. And he was spent. And the poor little guy, 9 years old, he cried all the way back down. Not because he was being whiny, but literally because his body had nothing left to give. He just leaked tears all the way down. But it was such treacherous walking that I couldn't carry him. And I'm like, I'm sorry, bud, but we have to keep going. It was dark by the time we got back. We were so exhausted. We didn't even have dinner. We got back to our tents and just fell into bed. It took us 19 hours to summit and come back. It was unbelievable, but he did it. And the next day you should have seen his face, how proud and excited he was. So that's my story, but you did the same thing with your son when he was 9 years old.
Yes. The peak was a little bit lower. I don't remember the footage, but it's the same general idea. In Massachusetts, there's not a ton of places you can actually climb. And this is a climb that you can do pretty manageably. There's some hand over hand stuff, but there's nothing that you're like, you don't need ropes or anything. And it is, however, low enough that there are runners who summit and down, summit and down, summit and down. And they'll do this. It's very annoying to watch the people like flying past you, especially on those like scream moments like you were describing. People who look like they're levitating across it because they've just done it so many times.
Yeah.
That they just are masters. But we got right to the top of the tree line. And I remember this moment where he was just ready to be done. He was like, nope, we're going down. And I was like, no, nope, we're not. We're going for it, buddy. And we got up there and had our lunch or whatever on the summit. And it's right in the right spot that you can just see Boston on the skyline. So it's just this perfect spot. And then
nice
coming down. It was just great. And again, it was that sort of look of, I just did that. you know, and
yes,
the thing that was fascinating to me, again, coming back to this Andy Kolber idea, challenging both of our sons, apparently, ideally within the window of tolerance, is so good.
Yeah, for my son, we were very much outside of his window of tolerance. We far exceeded his capacity or what his perceived capacity was. And the fact that he made it back to camp was just amazing. So it's been a source of strength that he could draw on ever since, because when he does hard things, he can come back to that moment and go, I know that there's way more in the tank than I could have ever dreamt. And he can draw on that resource, and his window of tolerance expanded exponentially as a result.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. So apparently it was both of us.
Okay. That's a fun one.
So, well, we on for next week?
Let's do it. I can't wait.
All right. I'll talk to you then.
All right. Bye.
Bye. What?